In this series this weekend, we're going to be looking at emotions in the Christian family. And I would like to start with this presupposition that our emotions are God-given. They are not a trick of the devil. Emotions are that beautiful motivational force in life that involves us in the kinds of interactions that are appropriate because God has created us and given us the capacity to be emotional. Jesus, in his life recorded in the Gospels, displayed the full range of human emotions. And because we have him as a model, we then can look at how Jesus handled emotions and find ways that we can handle them as singles, as couples, as families. By definition, the word emotion is from a Latin root that means to stir up. Our emotions are relatively strong, uncontrollable feelings that are accompanied by physiological changes, and they often affect our behavior. That little definition leads my wife to say to me every once in a while, "Relax. Don't get your liver in a quiver." Because this is part of the physiological upheaval that comes when things are beginning to get to us, either positively or negatively. You see, our thoughts can affect our emotions, and our emotions will influence our thoughts. And both emotions and thoughts influence our behavior. So, we cannot live without emotions. And if we try to, we cut ourselves off from the very element that makes it possible for us to be human and to respond to the way that God has created us with all of the repertoire and gifts that he has given to us to be normal, healthy, interactional individuals. Now, there are a number of characteristics about emotions that I think are important for us to look at the outset of this kind of a discussion. We notice, first of all, that we are born with only one emotion. That is the emotion of excitement. Therefore, if you were born with only one, that simply means that all emotions are learned. And so you cannot blame the color of your father's hair or the parentage of your mother for whatever you consider to be the stubborn streak or the bent toward anger or the other uncontrolled displays that can come in our lives together. Our emotions will go all the way from being pleasant to unpleasant because some of them feel so good we want to repeat them, and some of them are so frustrating that we will actually say, "Boy, I hope I never have to go through that again." Our emotions vary in intensity all the way from being very strong to being so weak and mild that we hardly realize that we are emotionally involved. Our emotions may be either good or bad, depending on how we interpret them and how we respond to them. Our emotions will draw us in an approach toward an object, or they can repel us and make us want to avoid a situation or a person. Our emotions may be wholesome, constructive, or they may actually be sinful. And our emotion or response to emotion will be very deeply influenced by our culture. The influence of culture simply says to us that crying, for instance, how to cry is innate, but when to cry is learned. Have you gals ever turned on the waterworks just to get your way? Don't look at me in that tone of voice. You know you have. That's part of the feminine mystique. At least it is at our house. But when we cry will be determined by what we have been taught. And if we have been taught that it's never right to emote, then we can become very sterile, cold-appearing individuals. Also, our emotions are cumulative. That just simply means they build up. Oh, I can see it now. You've worked hard all day and you've really given everything you could to the job, and then you come home, you walk in the door and the toys are on the floor and you smell a burnt offering coming out of the kitchen. And one word leads to another, and all of a sudden there's an explosion. It didn't begin in the living room or the kitchen. Probably began early in the morning driving to work. And when things stacked level upon level upon level, all of a sudden, it was more than could be handled, and there was the explosion. The fact that emotions are cumulative, and that knowledge can save you from some very unhappy emotional displays. If you can learn to shift gears between encounters, and if you can learn to take just a time to relax and change your perception so that you don't let it keep building up on you. And then our emotions happen to us. We do not choose them. Now, this is kind of hard for us to handle sometimes, because emotions actually are the result of an accumulation of life, and they motivate us. And we don't just sit down and say, now I'm going to be happy, so get happy, or now I'm going to be sad, so let's be sad. But it happens to us, and many times we don't realize what's happening to us until we back off and start looking objectively to that emotion. You see, all behavior is caused, but we're not always aware of the cause, and this is especially true when it comes to the interaction of emotions in our lives. There are three levels on which we will respond to emotions. First of all, we will experience emotion as a subjective experience, something that is happening to me without rhyme or reason. I would come to my wife in the early months of our marriage, coming in from work, and she would be busy generally in the kitchen washing dishes. I don't know why, but that's where I seemed to find her every time I came home. And she'd be quiet and didn't have much to say, and I would come around as a very inquisitive young groom and say, what's the matter? Nothing. Well, what's wrong? Oh, nothing. In desperation, I'd say, well, what have I done wrong now? And finally, she'd halfway look up and say, oh, you haven't done anything wrong. And see that exasperated, confused look on my face. And finally, she would say, when I figure it out, I'll tell you. Until then, just don't bug me. Well, I was off the hook. At least I knew it wasn't my fault. But what had put her into that mood would escape me completely. Generally, before bedtime, she'd be able to come around to me and say, well, I finally figured it out, and tell me what was wrong. It could have been a phone call, a letter. And I've often accused her that if the world didn't turn just right around the guiding light, she'd get depressed on that too. But really, whatever was bothering her was totally irrelevant to our relationship and our marriage. And I think probably one of the first struggles that we had to work with in those earlier years of the marriage was to come to an awareness that each had a private emotional life that the other one didn't share and didn't need to. But when she was able to come to me and say, I think I've got a handle on it now, and here's what I think it is, then I could deal with her words. But until she was able to put a label on whatever she was experiencing, I was totally in the dark, and I didn't know what to do. Now, I had two alternatives. One was to press and push for an immediate answer. And since she's Holland Dutch, that would have led to a violent explosion worse than the collapsing of the dikes. And so I knew not to do that one. And the other one would be to go off in a huff and pout until she finally got it straightened out, and then I wouldn't be in any mood for reconciliation or understanding. And what we learned in our interaction together was, if I would give her time and space to figure out what was happening to her, then we could deal with it on a cognitive, meaningful, understanding level. So this then leads us to the second level of emotional understanding, and that's our overt behavior, where we actually put into action what we're feeling. The problem here is that we do have the capacity to mask over or cover up our feelings. And there are some people who just pull a window shade down over their faces and they just don't let you know what's going on behind the curtain. I have seen people in professions who had that capacity to draw the blind so effectively that nobody could even suspect the inner turmoil that was going on inside of them. On the other hand, our behavior can be faked. We can pretend. We can act happy when we're not. We can act sad when we're not. And so just an observation is not going to be a solution. I often suggest to the students at the college that they pretend with me they're walking down the hall of a dormitory, looking in the window, and there is a young lady sitting on the bed with a letter in her lap, dabbing at her eyes with Kleenex. And ask them to guess, what's the matter with her? What do you think would be the matter with a young lady in college with a letter in hand crying? Come on. What could be wrong? Homesick. Something in her eye. Pragmatic man. What else could it be? Waiting for a teenager to say it. A Dear John letter, right. He probably wrote one in his life. Yeah, a Dear John letter. Bad news from home, anywhere from death to bankruptcy. Would be very devastating to someone away from home. What else could it be? Good news. Because don't you weep for joy? But why did it take us so long to get to the good part? Because our first assumptions with tears is it's negative. This then leads us to the actual internal physiological changes that occur in us with our emotions. You see, the sympathetic nervous system is a reflexive approach to survival. We call it visceral reinforcement, which means that all of the internal organs of the body are coming together to get the body in a state of readiness or alertness. Adrenaline from the adrenal gland hits the heart, the lungs, the liver, strengthens the muscles, and makes a person strong enough to do almost superhuman feats. It also sends the brain into neutral, and we can say and do some very stupid things. It has been reported from Vietnam that some of our fellows were driving in a Jeep headed over a hill and all of a sudden realized they were descending into an enemy ambush. The four of them jumped out of the Jeep. Each one grabbed a fender, turned that Jeep around on that narrow trail because there was no room to maneuver the car, and headed back to base. When they got to base, reported what they had done. They were asked to get out and do it again. They couldn't budge it. Why? Visceral reinforcement. Because under the panic of survival, saving their lives, they were able to accomplish something they couldn't in ordinary circumstances. And our news reports very frequently tell us of automobile accidents where one person will lift a car and another one will pull the victim out from under it and do all kinds of superhuman things. I can remember one story of a fire in which a man was standing down on the ground. His wife was 2 to 3 stories above in a burning building. The police or the firemen hadn't gotten there. There were no nets. There was no one to go rescue her. The fire was already in the room where she was. The reporter on the scene says that the man said to his wife, "Jump, I'll catch you." And she jumped. And he stationed himself at the spot where he thought she would come. And she dropped right into his arms. He bent his knees with the weight and set her down on the ground. No problem. Not even a strained muscle. And the reporter said, "How did she feel?" And his answer was, "As light as a feather." And yet the weight of the body dropping that far and being caught would be enough to tear muscles and tendons or break bones. But it didn't happen because of the emotional arousal. Then there is the parasympathetic part of our nervous system, which shuts down the reaction and restores the brain to its rightful control of the body, which simply says to us, when we are emotionally aroused, we should not make decisions, and we should have a very expert control on our movements. I have never yet seen a man who intended to batter his wife or beat his child. But I have had to work in my practice with men who lost control, did something they really wish they had not have done, simply because they were not in touch with themselves enough to direct their energies or to restrain their behaviors. Now, let's look at how our emotions come. We've already noticed that we are born with only one, and it is called excitement. Our emotions begin to build on both positive and negative sides of the center pole of excitement. On the negative side, distress is developed in the newborn child within the very first month. Anger develops between the third and the sixth month. Disgust about the same time. And jealousy emerges down here at about the 18th month in a normal child. Which just simply says if you plan your children 18 months apart, you build in a perfect setup for sibling rivalry. Sorry about that. Wish we could have told you before you started planning. But it's true, the very spacing of our children and their emotional repertoire will add to the kinds of things that occur in family interaction. And you see, these negative emotions then will generalize and include such dimensions as dejection, shame, agony, horror, and rage. On the positive side, however, within the second month, the first positive emotion occurs, which is called delight or pleasure. During the 6 to 12 months, elation is very prominent. Affection for adults begins somewhere between months 10 and 12, and then affection for children about the 18th month, and then joy around the 20th month, and then these will generalize to include happiness, elation, hope, and ecstasy. So, we are born with only one emotion. All the rest are learned. The first learned emotion is usually negative, related to survival and comfort. And then the positive ones begin to occur. And the child who is given the proper attendance and attention during those early years develops the full repertoire of emotionality and also learns to enjoy the pleasant emotions as well as having to use negative emotions to control a family. Incidentally, you know my definition for child psychology. It's the way kids manipulate their parents. To be human is to feel the full expression of emotions that will take us all the way from fear to love. Now, I want to remind you that God has created us with the capacity for experiencing this full range of emotions and feelings. Your emotions are not bad. They are a gift of God, and if you don't enjoy them, if you don't utilize them, then you're not enjoying all the dimensions of being a normal, healthy human, yes, and Christian. I would suggest to you that no feeling is bad. It is only how we respond to that feeling that creates the problem. I am working with a young woman, married, two children, who is in conflict with the neighbor next door. Now, I grant you the neighbor is making some very unnecessary demands, and he is being more obnoxious than necessary. But this gal came to me for counseling with the announcement, "I'm angry, and I want to punch his lights out." And I listened. I listened without judgment because I knew that her anger was not at the neighbor. And within a 50-minute hour, she had worked her way back and pinned the anger on her mother-in-law, who lives 1,000 miles away. But there have been problems since she married the son of that family and took him away. And that level of anger has continued to rise. And although the current problem has no relationship to her early marital experiences, she has that level of anger built in. Now she tells me that her anger is turning against God for putting her in those kinds of circumstances where she is feeling so ill at ease. And needless to say, I have a very heavy task on my hand to help her become accountable for her own behavior, to learn how to deal with that anger constructively and not let it eat her up. Because if she continues with the kinds of emotional responses she has now in mid-20s, she will be hospitalized for depression before she's 40 because she's building it up with her anger. And just in case you would like to know, depression that hits so frequently in the middle years is generally the result of three emotions that we're going to talk about this week: guilt, fear, and anger. And this gal's already into the anger. But that anger is coming from some behaviors that she has been doing that are contrary to her mother's, her mother-in-law's religious beliefs. So that's bringing guilt. And then because God is up there and not approving what she's doing, that's bringing fear. And so she's caught in the bind that sets up a depressive experience. So our task then as normal human individuals to learn our emotional experiences is to become friendly with our feelings. And if we take them seriously, they will bring stability to our lives, they will add flavor, and they will save us from ourselves. You see, emotions are what motivate behavior. And you have to get in touch with them and really be able to determine what's happening to you to have a grip on life. Emotions are the spice of life. Love and joy are generalized feelings rather than specific emotions because they penetrate all of the dimensions of healthy living. One of the views to emotional responding says that when things happen, our bodies react. We label that state of emotions. Then our bodies report what is happening and the mind responds later and motivates the behavior, which simply means you have a physical response that triggers you to say, hey, that made me scared, or that made me happy, or that made me angry, and then we have whatever is the emotion that we felt was appropriate at that particular time. So let us move then to the stages of emotional responding and look at the kinds of things that we do in responding to this God-given capacity to be a feeling person. The first is perception. Perception is when a part of the body, a receptor, is stimulated by some type of an external force or stimulus. Feeling, touching, hearing, seeing, tasting, smelling. These are the receptors that I'm talking about. And when any one of the bodily senses responds to whatever is happening around us, that message goes up to the brain. The brain takes the past, the present, and the future of your continuity of an immortal person that will live eternal, puts it into the light of what's happening right now, and gives you the idea of responding positively or negatively or maybe even in neutral to whatever is going on. This then is part of the appraisal, which is the judgment of what's happening and making it labeled either good or bad or harmful or pleasant or whatever it's going to be. As a result of your appraisal or how you see what's happening to you, then the emotion comes. Now, this emotion is a felt tendency to respond toward the stimuli that you have judged to be good or bad. And if it's good, you're going to be drawn toward it or away from it if it's bad. That then will lead you to an expression. And this will be the pattern of bodily changes that will be organized to make you either approach or withdraw. And with each emotion, there is a different set of responses that we have learned to make. Which simply means I respond to my wife very differently depending on what's going on in my head. Now, there's nothing that I enjoy more when I come home from work than for her to stop what she's doing, come to the door and greet me with a kiss, and maybe even help me take some of the stuff I'm carrying in or hang up my coat, and together we sort of make that entrance into the house together. Now, I like that. And she knows I like it. In the early years of our marriage, I would come home. I would lay everything down and go to where she was, and I told you it would have her hands in the sink. And I would throw my arms around her and try to lay a kiss on her cheek, and she'd get just as stiff as a board. And I said to her one day, "I can't understand you. When my daddy did that to my mama, she just melted in his arms." And my wife said, So I backed off. And she said, "Besides, I don't like to be bothered when my hands are wet." So the next day when I came home, I reached down and picked up the first tea towel I could find, held it by the corner, and walked across the floor. And she dried her hands, and then she responded the way I wanted her to. The whole thing being, we had to learn to establish a mutual expression of emotionality, where when I approached, she was receptive. Because if she wasn't, then I would feel very, very rejected and down. Oh, and those special times when she takes the initiative to greet me and to make me feel welcome really do mean a lot. Last night I had worked until 9 o'clock. After finishing my work at the college, I had 4 hours in the counseling office, so I didn't get home till after 9:30, and I came in with both hands full, and it was just kind of neat when she just stopped me and planted herself right between me and the hallway and kissed me and let me know that she was glad I was home, even if it was a lot later than usual. And it really made me feel good. Then last of all comes the action to emotions, which is our approach or withdrawal that will occur, and another emotion can interfere with it, but usually we have the opportunity to carry out one emotional response before another one will catch us in a crossfire. With this, I think it's appropriate to look at the dimensions of emotions and see the spectrum of what we're talking about. Robert Plutchik suggests that there are basically these eight dimensions of emotions. Anticipation, which has to do with eagerness and excitement. Anger, which can go all the way from annoyance to anger to rage. Then there's joy, which can begin as quietly as calmness and serenity, moving to pleasure and happiness and joy, all the way out to the extreme exaltation of ecstasy. There is a fourth dimension of acceptance, a dimension of surprise. There is a dimension of fear, and this sixth dimension of fear will go all the way from timidity through apprehension to fear, and then on out to panic and terror. There also is a dimension of sorrow, which is very normal, disgust, which also is normal. And then I would suggest that it is possible for us to experience a combination of these different emotions at different intensities at the very same time. Have you ever experienced a guilt-tinged happiness or been plagued with mixed emotions? Have you been so caught up you didn't know whether to laugh or cry? And maybe you tried both. That guilt-tinged one always intrigues me, because that's when you go buy that new outfit, or at least put it in layaway, and then you go back to balance the checkbook and realize that you couldn't afford it, but it was so pretty, and Easter is so close, and so you went ahead and kept it, and you put it on to wear it, and you had that guilt-tinged emotion. My experience has been the longer you wear it, the less the guilt. And so you learn to handle that emotion. But these are the kinds of things that can leave us with a feeling that maybe will not be quite so clear, and yet it is so marvelously healthy. Now, emotions, healthy emotions, demand striking a balance between three dimensions of our life. Our thinking, our feeling, and our doing, better known as cognition, emotion, and behavior. You see, many of us have been taught to think that our emotions are not good, and therefore we do not give ourselves the privilege of responding emotionally. Have you ever heard a mother seeing her little child fall off of a tricycle, obviously skinning his knee and crying, say through a kitchen window, "Boys don't cry," or "Big men don't cry like that," or "Be a big man like your daddy"? The unfortunate thing here is that men who do not learn to cry effectively in childhood grow up to be awfully lousy lovers. And one of the major problems I run into in counseling is men who are feeling intensely have been taught that any feelings like that are wrong, therefore they can't express them. And then the wives will wonder why on earth he never talks to me or talks about a breakdown of communication. But you see, this has been engendered when mothers inhibit boys from making the normal expression for hurt, if hurt indeed has occurred, or excitement and love, if a good feeling has occurred. Many of us talk about loving, but we don't know how to respond lovingly. Why? We haven't seen it. It is astonishing to me how many men come into counseling that have never been hugged or kissed by their fathers, and have never felt that it is proper to display affection to a man that you love. I remember with great delight an event recently when my son took me to the airport, and he's 20. And as I was getting ready to leave for a lengthy time, as I was turning to get into the line to go onto the airplane, he reached over and kissed me on the cheek. And for a boy of 20 to do that in a public place just made me feel very comfortable and very proud to be his father. So you see, our task as men and also as women is to fuse our thinking, feeling, and behavior so that it is appropriate. It's loyal to what we're experiencing, and it's also correct in the situation where we are. I can remember a cousin of mine whose father bragged that from the time the boy was 12, they shook hands. They never touched in a hug or a pat or any sign of affection. And I have no doubt that that may be why my cousin had to get into his second marriage before he could learn to be appropriately affectionate and responsive to a wife. Our emphasis on feeling leads to a life that is dull and bland if we inhibit our feelings. On the other hand, if we allow it to get into control, it leads to all kinds of excessive emotional displays. These reveal themselves in temper tantrums and rebellions and things of that nature. In fact, it does deserve notice that many young people in rebellion are actually just trying to express an inhibited emotion. We also have to notice that an emphasis on behavior where we're so much on to the behavior itself can lead us to sit at home and do nothing if we feel down, or to be out of control and manic-y behavior, and we run into that manic depressive cycle where a person, when he's up, is very up, and when he's down, he's very down. I can't remember the name of the little gal in literature that said when she was good, she was very good, and when she was bad, she was horrid. Well, some of us may fall into that category as well. Now, we need to be able to process emotions and see what's happening when they are occurring to us. And although it's not always easy to do, there are basically three levels of processing. Cognition is the thinking level, emotion is the feeling level, and behavior is the doing level. And when we recognize that our emotions are a part of us to think, to feel, and we have a right to respond to them, then we can handle them effectively. And now I want to show you how. In dealing with emotions in the Christian family, every member of that household needs to learn, first of all, to feel your emotions. By feel, I mean just feel them all the way to your toes until your toes tingle. To begin with, I don't care if it's fear, anger, hate, love, disgust, guilt, or what it is, feel it. Come alive with the emotionality that God has given you the capacity to experience. Second, name your emotions. In naming them, I'm simply saying you have to put a label on them. Putting a label on emotions is very difficult simply because it requires us to experience them first. Ironically, anger and fear feel very, very much alive. And there are many people who cannot handle their emotions simply because they have not labeled them, and therefore they respond inappropriately. Then channel your emotions. Use that emotional energy that comes by the physiological stir-up and channel it into something constructive. This can be handled through athletics, jogging, all types of contact sports, even to tennis or golf or whatever you like for expression. And for some of you gals, when it's been a lousy morning and your husband has been a grouch and the kids have been impossible and you finally get them all off to school and work, It's a marvelous day to attack that closet that's been cluttering for years. Just go in there and throw everything out of it. Just throw it as far as you want to. And clutter up the room that you're in. Then organize it, separate it, sort it. Whatever you're going to keep, label it, stack it back in the closet. You'll feel like a new woman. And you will have accomplished one of those spring cleaning tasks that will make you very, very proud of yourself. So you see, there are appropriate ways to handle emotions and also to get some rather sticky tasks done. Now, in responding emotionally, we need to recognize that we have to get a label on what's happening to us. Because with fear and anger feeling so much alike, it can really be easy for a man who feels threatened, for a man who is afraid he's going to lose his wife or a child or respect or money or a job, to just double up his fists when he's scared and attack. Because what he's really experiencing is fear, not anger. But since fear is not a masculine emotion, he's not used to doing it that way. And so he backs off. Our emotions communicate to others something about our inner selves. And I would suggest to you that our emotional behavior must be congruent with our testimony. Therefore, we need to say and act the same way at the same time. There is such a thing as a double message, where the words and the nonverbal expression are at odds. I can fold my arms, lean back stiffly, grit my teeth, and say, "I love you," and communicate a pretty sour message. Or I can lean toward my wife and whisper in her ear, "I love you," and come with a total different response. Now, this is what I mean by the double message. And I remind you again that 55% of the message in communication comes from expressions, from the bodily posture, from the tone of voice, and the nonverbal parts of communication. Actually, the verbal part will be about 38% of the communication, 55% be the nonverbals, and only 7% from the actual words that we are using. We also have to be careful to avoid reactive behavior in which we overreact. And so I would say that our key here should be act, but don't react to what's occurring. Now, our emotions can be a very meaningful source of tension, the kind of tension that we need to get a handle on. First of all, there is anxiety that is a source of tension, and all of us are living in a world of anxiety. It's been stated that the last decade has been noted as the decade of anxiety. I'm using anxiety here to refer to that vague, unpleasant set of feelings of discomfort that usually come from unknown causes, such as worry, apprehension, dread, or misgivings. This will come when we're separated from support, whether it's physical or emotional. This comes when a family is moving, when children are being uprooted from friends and school, when someone that we love has died and they're no longer there to be nurturing to us. This will bring anxiety. Anxiety comes when there's an anticipation of punishment, or when there's an anticipation that the list for the cheerleaders is being posted and we don't have the nerve to go look at that list until after the service because we didn't want to have to handle that emotion during the evening. There is the emotion that comes with an inner conflict when we don't really know what we're doing and maybe what we are doing is inconsistent with what it ought to be. Anxiety also comes with the uncertainty about the future, where we're not clear you know, the economic situation the way it is, the energy crisis the way it is, who knows what if, and all of a sudden we can get ourselves so tight that we can't even enjoy normal interactions. The second form of tension is in frustration. This is basically when you're running into a brick wall, you've been making a forward movement, and all of a sudden, bang, you can't go any further. And the question is, what do you do when life tells you, no, you can't do it? Now, these no signals bring an unpleasant feeling, simply because our forward movement has been blocked and satisfaction has been delayed. This will come from delays, many of which are unavoidable, and so we find ways to work off our impatience. It can come from obstacles, physical obstacles or events. Coming into my counseling session last night, the first family was 10 minutes late. And I heard them come bounding up the stairs as those little 7 and 8 year old girls hit the stairs as fast as they could to be the first up. Mother came up behind them, panting and winded, and said, "There was a train on the track." As though 5 minutes, 3 minutes, 2 minutes was going to be a major catastrophe in life. But they were really trying their best to get there, and they'd been blocked by an obstacle. And you know, I think that's a pretty good reason to stop, don't you? A train across the track? But, oh, they were so apologetic, and I wasn't frustrated at all. It gave me time to finish my supper before I started work. Then there are the social and legal obligations that we run into that will not allow us to do it because it's against the law, or society says no, or the church doesn't agree with it. And it does set parameters and barriers on our life. And then there are the personal obstacles that come, such as physical limitations of seeing and hearing or other handicaps, and those unrealistic expectations that we put on ourselves so that we are being defeated by somebody else's aspirations. How do we resolve conflict in the frustration area? I'm going to give you 3 strategies for dealing with frustration, and if you will listen to me, it will save your emotional life. The first way, don't do it, is apathy, surrender. When life tells you no, the apathetic way is just to give up and say, "Well, I didn't want to anyway," or, "Oh, well, it's not that important," or, "That's the way the cookie crumbles." And just lie down and let life walk over you, and you become a rug and lifeless as a result. Frankly, that one leads to emotional suicide, and too frequently, an actual suicide. Another way to handle emotion, and this is my recommendation to you, is to lower your profile or your demands and work constructively within the system until you can bring about the needed changes. You see, you may have a bright idea, but it could be before it's time. One of the things that I learned when I was an associate pastor was to keep feeding my senior pastor with ideas. And very frequently he would say, "No, I don't think we want to do that now." But I would, you know, give him a proposal and an idea. And just wait, knowing that in 6 to 8 months he would come to my desk and say, "Hey, Ray, here's something I think might work. Why don't you see what you can do with this?" And he would give me my idea back, and then I would go ahead and develop it. And it's amazing how successful it was, and it was all his idea. That's one way of perpetuating yourself in a situation and also allowing yourself to rise to the top until you can be in the decision-making capacity yourself. Now, there's a third one, and it is debatable, but sometimes it's appropriate, and that's to leave the scene of the frustration. And I honestly believe that there is a time when it's appropriate to leave rather than to stay and become a point of controversy, particularly in Christian service. I don't think we need to stay and grind axes, but I do think that we need to learn to work constructively and cooperatively, and this can help us handle our frustration and also keep us from being an obvious frustration to someone else. The third way that we receive tension from emotions has to do with conflict. Now, conflict is different from frustration in that conflict has a choice. Frustration is you're going in a straight line and you're blocked. You can't go anywhere. Conflict is you come to a Y in the road. You can go right or left, but you can't go straight ahead. One direction represents a positive move, the other one a negative move. If both of your options are positive, we call it an approach-approach conflict, the kind of thing when a guy has his little black book and he doesn't know whether he wants to date the blonde or the brunette tonight. He can't date them both, so he has to make a choice. I don't know whether any of you fellows ever had that problem or not, but it is one of the better problems of emerging manhood. Then there are those avoidance conflicts where you don't want to do either one of them. For you high school kids, what are you going to do first, mow the lawn or change the flat on your car and you have to be at work in 2 hours? Well, you'd much rather go out and play or do something else, but the lawn has to be done and the flat has to be changed. So it's just a matter of which negative thing we're going to do first. And then there are those mixed blessings where both ways has a positive and a negative in it. The old cliche used here is certainly not original, but the best definition I have ever seen for mixed emotions is the feeling that a man has when he watches his mother-in-law driving off the cliff in his new Cadillac. The fourth area for tension is pressure. And this is the kind of pressure that comes from our own personal ambitions. It's the kind that comes from family expectations and the kind that comes from the society in which we live. There are pressures on us constantly. Pressures, conflict, frustration, anxiety, are those demonstrations of emotionality that give us the opportunity to get in control of our life or to surrender to its demands. In the remaining sessions of this weekend, and we'll take a break before we go further, I want to start in the book of Genesis with you, and we're going to work our way through Genesis to look at the order in which emotions occur. The very first emotion that appears for man in the Bible is found in Genesis chapter 2 in the scripture, verse 18, that says, "It is not good for man to be alone." So we will look first at loneliness, then we'll look at guilt and fear and anger, and other emotions will transpire. We certainly won't get through the whole repertoire of emotions in this short weekend, but at least we'll be able to give you an introduction of emotions as they occur in the Christian family.